Okay, well, the first thing I want to say is I'm glad to be here. I haven't been to the Institute in a while, and so it's glad to be good to be back. And I am thankful to the organizers for inviting me. I guess I have to apologize that I have nothing glossy to say today, so I hope that the organizers don't throw me to the ocean, particularly because I forgot my swimsuit in Urbana, thinking it was going to be much too cold for that here. Right. Although you float quite nicely here, because you know, the ocean here is a bit like minestrone soup, right? There's a lot of vegetables and oil and... All right, so I'm going to talk about liquid crystal phases in strongly correlated systems. And for those of you in the audience who know about liquid crystals, I promise that to you that you will not see any complicated, interesting quasi-one-dimensional molecules. What you're going to see essentially are complicated quasi-two-dimensional systems with point electrons that behave as if they were like liquid crystal molecules. Okay, so we're going to talk about the anisotropic states of point particles today. So my collaborators, at least for most of what I'm going to talk about, are Steve Kivelson and Vadim Oganessian. Much of what I will talk about originated in work that Steve and I did with Vic Emery, who passed away about a year ago. So this talk is dedicated to his memory. Okay, so unfortunately, I think I prepared probably a talk that is a bit too long for the time I have. We'll see if I have time to talk about some of the experiments which I think are interesting to look at. But I will first discuss what do we mean by liquid crystal phases in these strongly correlated electronic systems. We'll talk about an example of that, which is an isotropic phase of the two-dimensional electron gas in large magnetic fields. We'll talk about the phases that each one of these liquid crystal-like states can support, in particular the phases of quantum smectics. I will give you a description of quantum pneumatic states, both weak and strong coupling. And then we're going to talk, if I have time, I will discuss the notion of fluctuating order, which is like being half pregnant, as you can imagine, okay, because either there is order or there isn't. And experimentally, people talk about fluctuating stripes or fluctuating this or fluctuating that. Of course, that needs to be made more precise. And if I have time, I'll discuss that, talk about a few applications, and hopefully show you some experiments. Okay, so of course the motivation for much of this is the infamous phase diagram of the high temperature superconductors, okay? And as you probably heard more times than you wish you had, there are essentially two phases that we all agree with, that there is an insulating state, usually called the Mott insulator. There is typically at the end of this x equals zero, x being the doping variable. There is usually long-range order of some sorts. Typically, it's an anti-ferromagnetic order. At intermediate ranges here, there is a superconducting state, which is the Holy Grail. And then there is a lot of stuff in between, what people call a pseudo-gap. Okay, it means that there isn't an actual gap, but it's almost like that, so that's why it's called pseudo-gap. And then there are various sorts of order states, or quasi-order states, that are seen experimentally, and much of that is a question of discussing where these quasi-order states are part of the, that's the relevance of this, whether they are part of the mechanism for the superconducting state, which is of course what one would like to know, or whether they are a problem for the superconductivity that needs to be overcome in order to get into a true superconducting state. Now there is evidence of sort of charge order of various sorts, in particular stripe order that I will call here smectic because it's sort of quasi one-dimensional and looks more or less like a smectic state in a classical liquid crystal, in underdoped high temperature superconductors, particularly in the lanthanum materials and in YBCO, in this intermediate regime over here, and when superconductivity just begins, mostly by tranquada and neutron scattering and by undoing transport. There is evidence of quote coexistent charge order and superconductivity in lanthanum strontium copper oxide and to a lesser extent in YBCO. This is again neutron scattering by Mook and Tranquada, but the YBCO data is not as clean as the lanthanum data. Now, more recent STM experiments in VSCO suggest the existence of short-range stripe order on a length scale which is one order of magnitude longer than the coherence length of the superconductor, and therefore it's appreciable in the system, in systems in VSCO in particular. And this came in data from all of these three groups. There's a great deal of controversy about the interpretation of the experiments in the sense whether this is what is seen or whether what they see is essentially only quasi-particle propagation in addition to this. And I suppose my collaborator Kapitulnik agrees with me on this, at least most days. Seamus Davis, I don't think he ever agrees with me, ever, except sometimes when he talks to me. And when he wants to talk to me, I suppose. And Ali Yazani, my colleague in Urbana, I guess he is polite. And I interpret his data in the way I like. I'm not sure what he says when he gives talk. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about charge and spin order in dot-mod insulators. So these insulators are strongly correlated insulators. They are not band insulators. It's not just simply that the quantum mechanics of non-interacting particles wants the system to be insulating. It's a result of strong interactions. And therefore, much of the physics is very different from essentially one-electron physics. We are very far from that limit. Now, many of the systems exhibit a lot of what people sometimes call nanoscale structures. In other words, it is as if the electrons arrange themselves at intermediate length scales between independent particles and uniform fluids. Okay? So for people working in classical pattern nucleation type physics, this is not new, but in quantum mechanics, it's not as well an established fact. And these are probably the first systems where this is actually registered and confirmed. So for instance, this is seen in the so-called stripe phases on the cuprates. There are stripe phases in other materials, similar types of materials like the manganites and the nickelites. They differ from the cuprates in that they have a much larger electron-phonon coupling and there are larger distortions. There are big fat atoms that move, and therefore these structures are fairly classical once they are formed in those systems. Whereas in the cuprates, they are much more quantum mechanical, at least I believe they are. There is a similar phenomenon that we'll discuss in a moment of the so-called anisotropic transport phase in the two-dimensional electron gas in large magnetic fields, although it's not, in my interpretation, a stripe, but an analog of kinematic, as you will see in a moment. Now, most of this physical mechanism is different from one system to another, but they're all driven by the following sort of competition. They usually have the long or longer range Coulomb interactions, which are repulsive, and there are always effective, attractive short-range forces driven typically by exchange or typically by the fact that if you have some kind of order and if you introduce effects, you have to pay some energy cost in order to destroy the order. And once you pay it, if you put another hole or another defect, it pays for the defects to be close to each other because you pay less energy than if they were farther apart. Of course, if they are charged, then you have the problem with the Coulomb interactions that don't like that. So there is this frustration, if you want, or the competition between these two types of systems. And typically what happens when, for reasons that have to do with the amount of charge in the system, if the uniform gap state is not allowed, you end up with spatially inhomogeneous states. Okay, and there are, of course, classical analogs that this audience knows better than I do, in ferrofluids, in block of polymers. There are astrophysical examples in the crusts of neutron stars. There are so-called pasta phases in lightly doped neutron stars with protons. And they come in three types. They have a midpole phase where the protons agglomerate into essentially a three-dimensional structure. They have a spaghetti phase where they form lines. And because these people have the unfortunate fact of living in three dimensions, they also have a lasagna phase because they form sheets. Okay, so. And this is actually work that was done actually in Urbana by Chris Pethick, Jeff Ravenhall, and others in the early 80s. And this, it's at least in that literature more or less well established. There are interesting analogs in the sense of comparing partition functions with the classical partition functions of lipid bilayers intercalated with DNA. So we are doing biophysics here. Okay, now you may say what we're doing here is either soft quantum matter or quantum soft matter, and I leave the order of the terms to you. Okay? So about 5 years ago, Steve Kivelson, Vikinger, and I wrote this paper in which we introduced this concept that when you dope a MOT insulator, typically you end up with a variety of phases that break translation and rotation symmetries in various ways. If you know the classical physics, this is natural, but at the quantum level, there are a number of things which are different. So we're all familiar with the uniform fluids that break no spatial symmetries, and we all that would like to think that a superconductor is one of those. And the other end of the spectrum, there are all the crystalline states that break continuous translation symmetries and rotations. And then you can have a number of possible intermediate states. You can have a spectric or striped state that breaks only translations in one direction and rotation symmetry. And you could have also nematic and perhaps hexatic phases as well. Whether it's one or the other depends on the coupling to the lattice and various other things. Okay, so there is a variety of phases of this type. If the coupling to the lattice is strong, as it is usually in the case in the high temperature superconductors, then none of these symmetries to begin with are continuous, they are usually discrete, and you end up with spontaneous breaking of some point group symmetry, but in some sense it's better to think about it in these terms. You can use the other language as well. On the other hand, at moderate to high temperatures, lattice effects are usually weak, and in that regime you can think of this as a continuous symmetry with essentially some weak potential in that regime. In other systems, such as the case of the two-dimensional electron gas in gallium arsenide heterostructures, the symmetries are essentially continuous since the lattice plays no role. Okay? So it depends on the physical system. So what are the properties of these phases as far as charge ordering is concerned? The liquid phase is isotropic, breaks no spatial symmetries, and typically the states are either conducting or superconducting. At the other end, you end up with electron solids, or if you want to call them charge density waves, but they have the same symmetries after all, and they are insulating states. The nematic state has lattice effects that will reduce the symmetry to rotations by pi over 2, if you want, which is Ising-like. Translation and reflection symmetries are unbroken, and this is an anisotropic fluid with a preferred axis. And the spectric phase, which is the so-called stripe phase, is the most popular state, if you want, has in principle an infinite anisotropy in the conductivity tensor, and is like liquid-like in one direction and solid-like in the other. Okay? So back then in our paper in 1998, we drew this Gedanken phase diagram. And I want to emphasize that this is, except for a dotted line there, for a piece of the dotted line there, there is no calculation behind this. So the only thing that we did is essentially to organize what we understand of this physical system more or less logically. So you have a temperature axis, and we have a quantum axis here. And of course, we don't mean that we ask Mr. Planck to change h bar. Of course, we can always change it by changing the units. We all know how to do that. We normally put it to one, after all. But what we mean by this is that is the question of what are the quantum fluctuations controlling what is some kind of coupling constant controlling the strength of the quantum fluctuations of the charge order states. Okay, so for instance, you could end up in a fairly classical regime where the system likes to crystallize, and I would like to think of, for instance, the manganites or systems like that to be mostly in this region. And you could imagine thermal melting directly into the isotropic fluid or going through a series of phase transitions. So either one of those is allowed. Similarly, you can imagine quantum melting from the crystal to the smectic, to the sum, to the nematic, to the uniform fluid, as you essentially crank up the quantum axis, so to speak. And in practice, what happens if you change the microscopic physics of the system, for instance, systems with large electron-phonon couplings, as I said, involve moving large fat atoms, and therefore they are more classical in that sense from this point of view. And I would put in that sense the manganites at this end of the spectrum, and the cuprates that have a less large, the electron-phonon coupling is not as large, and therefore one believes that much of what one is seeing is due to electronic correlations. Of course, is to some extent is a bit of what came first, the chicken or the egg. Once the symmetry is broken by an electronic mechanism, the lattice will follow, since there is always uncoupling. Yes. Yeah, actually, for instance, look, I drew them, so I can make them whatever I want. But typically this, for instance, this black line here was supposed to represent the Fourier transition. I mean, in principle, you could imagine softening the crystal to Smectic transition, but it's likely to be first order. On the other hand, the Smectic to pneumatic transition could be first order or second order, depending on microscopic properties. So you could imagine having a quantum critical point for this or not. Okay? Yes. Two dimensions. These are quasi two dimensional systems. In three dimensions, it's more complicated. Okay. All right, and this dotted line here came from a calculation in a stripe state or in a Smectic state, in which if you crank out the transversal fluctuations of the stripes, you find that the effective Josephson coupling between stripes goes up, and therefore the effective TC goes up. So it's an example of order from disorder, if you want. Okay. So in that sense, you expect that even though TC may be very small here, eventually will grow as you crank up the quantum fluctuation. So that's the only actual calculation, and is this dotted line here. Okay. But the value of this phase diagram is essentially in organizing in a logical way where these phases are supposed to sit. And of course, you could go directly from the crystal to the pneumatic without going through the Smectic. You could also go directly from the crystal to the isotropic fluid. Okay, so there is nothing sacred about this particular ordering of the phases. But it's a good way to think about it, at least to me. Okay, let me talk a little bit about the order parameters in this problem. So the Smectic or stripe state, if you can think of it as a unidirectional charge density wave, since it has a charge modulation, people call it a charge stripe. If it coexists with spin order, as it often does, it's also spin stripe. Okay? The spin stripe, so in the stripe state, there are new Bragg peaks in the electron density at the ordering wave vectors here, with a characteristic wavelength being the stripe period. If it is a spin stripe state, there are incommensurate magnetic Bragg peaks that appear as a deviation from the pi-pi, which will be typically in the ferromagnetic wave vector. The order parameter is very simple, just simply the component of the electron density with the wave vector being Q charge. Okay, it's quite simple. The pneumatic order is more interesting. On the basis of symmetry, essentially any object that behaves, that transforms as a symmetric traceless tensor will work. In two dimensions, on the other hand, the symmetric traceless tensor is equivalent to, essentially to a vector, actually to a director, not to a vector, but modulo that is okay. So, from a phenomenological point of view, there are various ways in which you can detect it. So, for instance, suppose somebody comes and gives you a dynamical structure factor, for instance, for charge, you can compute the equal time piece of that, which is integrating that by frequency, and you can form this quantity QK, which is obtained by taking this quantity that depends on the wave vector, and do the same, look at the same quantity at the rotated angle, say by pi over 2. And this quantity transforms under 90 degree rotations appropriately in the same way as a pneumatic order parameter should. Of course, this is what you will observe. The microscopic order parameter will come to later on. Okay, so this is a good way to detect pneumaticity if you want in an electronic fluid. Another way to do it is to look at the anisotropy of the resistivity tensor. Okay, and so if you form this particular ratio, it transforms in the same way, and therefore you can do it as well. So if you look at the anisotropic part of the resistivity tensor, it is indeed a symmetric traceless tensor and can be used, therefore, for the same purpose. Okay, so a number of years ago, I forgot when was this, about almost 4 years ago now, Jim Einstein and his Caltech group, and simultaneously and independently the Princeton Bell Labs group at the time, discover this beautiful anisotropy. So this is a two-dimensional electron gas in a system that can be described to be the liquid helium of electronic physics, since it's incredibly clean. Okay, you will see in a moment how clean it is. So this is a low temperature data. They go down to 25 millikelvin there. The samples are squares. These are the contacts. And they play this funny game in which they drive a current along the x-axis and look at the voltage drop along the x-axis. Then they turn the contacts around and they drive the current down the y-axis and measure the longitudinal conductance or resistance along the same direction, and the sample is a square. Everybody told us everything is symmetric, therefore they should see no difference. And in fact, at high temperatures and at zero field, there is a slight anisotropy of maybe 10% or 5%, which is usually scaled away and has always been there and was never actually in the published data. Okay, but then what they see is that as they go to low temperatures, the resistance in one, even though this is resistivity in this plot, is actually the resistance, what they're actually plotting here. The resistance goes up and has a strong, a very high and narrow peak. This is in the middle of a plateau in the second Landau level and above. And it has a finite width, so there's this big peak that appears. And the resistivity, the resistance in the y direction goes to small values, never goes to zero, but becomes very small, in such a way that the ratio of the maximum RxX to the minimum RyY becomes quite large, and the ratio goes between 100 and somewhere above 3000. And all of that happens on a very narrow temperature range below 100 millikelvin, and it takes off very, very rapidly. If you deconvolute the effects of the geometry, which a number of people did, then you find that instead of being such large numbers, it's between 7 and 23, but still quite sharp, and has a strong temperature dependence. All of that means that this is an effect of correlations. It's an ordering effect that you're seeing in this problem. It's not an effect of the material. The mobilities are big, like 3.3 times 10 to the 7th. The mean free path, or the nominal mean free path, is long. It's half a millimeter. Remember that the samples are 5 millimeters across, so you have only 10 nominal mean free paths across. So this is essentially a clean system as you ever saw. You can basically see the mean free path. Okay. The IV curves are linear in the region of the peak, and become non-linear at high voltages. There are no thresholds seen in the anisotropic regime, and they see sharp thresholds in the reentrant integer Hall effect wings, which I was showing here. There they see a reentrant integer Hall effect at outside those regions here. Similarly, they see no noise in the anisotropic regime, and they see broadband noise in the integer quantum Hall reentrant regime. Actually, some of the most spectacular broadband noise seen in electronic systems are in these materials. Yes. That's part of the question. Okay, I'll comment on that in a moment. So, as far as anybody can tell, the region in the middle of the peak, the system behaves like a strongly anisotropic fluid with a very strong temperature-dependent anisotropy. There is a background anisotropy that I will show in a moment. What there is an estimate of that. It's very small. Nobody knows what is the actual origin of that. There are suspicions about the growth process. Up to now, there is no real good candidate for that. But it's a very tiny energy scale involved in that. So it looks to, or at least to us, it looked like a nematic state in this sense. If it were to be a stripe state, you would have expected pinning. You would expect to see some kind of threshold field as in any charge density wave system. You may say, well, it will get rounded. They don't see anything that looks like round. It just looks linear. It looks like a strong anisotropic fluid. Okay, so in collaboration with Stratos Manoussakis and his student Juan Signo, and more recently this was done more extensively by Ken Cooper, who's a student with Jim Einstein, and the experimenters do their own Monte Carlo simulations now. Okay, so what we did is we did a classical Monte Carlo simulation. We took a classical XY model, which is a good description of a nematic order parameter in two dimensions. It's all classical. We haven't done any quantum mechanics here. And we put a small symmetry breaking field, H, to simulate the anisotropy. So you can extract after you deconvolute the data, you can plot you go from resistances to resistivities by doing some, partial differential equations and stuff like that. And then you form this ratio that I showed you before. The jagged curve is in the data. The dotted lines with the dots over there That's the Monte Carlo data. You can see the characteristic linear behavior here, which is typical of the spin wave approximation. So what you're seeing, in a sense, you're arguing that the anisotropy in the resistivity that I see, in a sense, is a measure of the order parameter of the system. It's a function of the order parameter. In other words, the anisotropy in the transport is a consequence of ordering in this problem. Okay, as a function of temperature. So in a sense, this is a plot of the equation of state. Okay? Now you can determine from the data what the effective J is. It's a number like 73 millikelvin. And the effective symmetry breaking field is very small. It's only 5% of the rigidity. And that is a number between 3.5 or up to 5 millikelvin. It's a very small energy scale. The typical energy scales on this problem are either the Coulomb scale, which is of the order of 1 Kelvin, or maybe the gap of the pair state, which isn't far from there, is a number like 300 millikelvin. So this is a tiny energy scale in this problem. And this is the energy scale that hasn't been observed. Now, you may say that what one is seeing is a rounded Kosterlitz-Thouless transition, rounded because there is an external symmetry breaking field. And that is so strongly pronounced because you have a divergence susceptibility below that point. Okay, that's why you see it. But you need this background anisotropy to see the effect. Okay?
How does scale change? What changes if you change H?
H is actually, well, what changes the fit of the curve. This is the best fit. Okay? Well, it just simply doesn't fit. We actually, what we did is we chose H in such a way that it fits the high temperature data up to about here. We don't expect the low temperature part to fit well. You see that it saturates. This could be various reasons for that. One could be quantum mechanical effects. The other could be disorder. But since systems are so clean, when they make them more dirty, what you see is that this curve saturates for a while, then it comes down. So in the dirtier systems, actually, because the disorder couples directly to the order parameter, it will act like a random field in that case, and the system probably will have some glassiness to it. And here we are trying to stay away from glassiness. I'm sorry for that. Okay.
Sorry, what
yes.
Do you actually plot for this Monte Carlo simulation of the XY model?
In the XY model, what you do is you plot the order parameter as a function of temperature at fixed background symmetry breaking field. Yes, it's a magnetization as a function of H and T. It's the equation of state.
And
okay.
Why did you choose XY and not I from
that? Because it's a system that has a continuous symmetry under rotations, and its rotations modulo pi instead of modulo 2 pi. It's a director, not a vector, but for these purposes it doesn't matter. Okay. Of course, if you have a lattice coupling, then it's different and it becomes Ising-like. Okay. So now this, let me come back now to high temperature superconductors and talk about the phases that these striped states may have. So these are quasi one-dimensional states, so you may imagine that what you are seeing essentially are the charge degrees of freedom being quote confined to one-dimensional structures that people call stripes. You can think of them as being arrays of these things, and therefore you can think of them as being an array of Luttinger liquids which may be allowed in some range to slide past each other, and that's where the term sliding Luttinger liquid comes from. There are strong forward scattering interactions between these different stripes which lead to marginal behavior, and then you have a host, actually an infinite number of Luttinger parameters in practice. In practice you only keep track of a few of them. The physics of the actual phases depend on the possible existence of a spin gap in each one of these phases, in each one of the stripes. The other feature that is important here is that pre-R tunneling in this context is the origin of superconductivity. That's how superconductivity evolves from this state. And if you have large interstripe 2KF couplings, then you end up with crystallization. So depending which one of these couplings becomes relevant, you may end up in one or many phases. Or for instance, if electron tunneling dominates, as it happens when the spin gap is not present, then you may end up into some kind of anisotropic Fermi liquid. You may say, you may call it pneumatic if you want.
Mother?
Yes.
What percent of the state of your stripe state is a radius sliding change in zero? Where are the
Well, okay, it depends. If there are no other couplings, they will slide in the sense that you can displace the, if you want, the electron, the charge profile of one relative to other at no cost. That means that there is no shear modulus. If, on the other hand, the interstripe 2KF couplings are relevant, then they crystallize. Okay, and so this is the way. So you imagine first that you have some putative two-dimensional Luttinger liquid phase, which is strongly, it's a bunch of one-dimensional systems in reality. And then you ask, what are the perturbations? Are they relevant, irrelevant, or marginal? Okay, that's the usual game. Okay, so if you play that game with a spin gap, you end up with, and you make a crude model involving only two of these Luttinger parameters, is the usual one, the intrastripe, and you keep the leading interstripe. In practice, to actually be more correct, you need more than one, and this was discussed in this paper by, I wrote with Vic and Steve and Tom Lewinsky. And there was an independent publication the same along the same lines by Ashwin Vishwanath and Carpentier. Okay. And in the case of the spin gap, the three phases that compete is the stripe crystal, which is a case where precisely these 2KF processes dominate, the SMECTEC superconductor, which is when pair tunneling dominates, and when all of these other couplings are irrelevant, you end up with SMECTEC metal. Okay, now in practice there is a line of first order transitions here, and there will be regimes where one of these other fluctuations becomes subdominant relative to the other. If there is no spin gap, in addition to that, you end up with a quote Fermi liquid like phase in the middle, which may evolve or not into a BCA superconductor or something more interesting, depending on the case. An important feature, and this has to do with the role of forward scattering interactions, is that even though at weak interstripe interactions you may have a crystal, as you crank up the interstripe interactions, you always end up with a superconductor. In other words, this is a leading relevant operator, this is irrelevant, and as you crank up this parameter, this becomes more relevant and this becomes less relevant. And at some point they cross. Okay. So you end up, so as you can see, you end up with complex phase diagrams even in this sort of quasi one-dimensional world that one has. Let me talk now, okay, what I would like to do, of course, is to have a theory which will describe the melting of these things. In other words, the quantum melting of the stripes. That's a hard thing to do. And we have been working on that, but barring that, what you can do is a theory of the phase, and then worry about the phase transition later. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you is how to describe the phases themselves. Now, how would we describe a quantum nematic state? Okay, so there are various ways you can do it. You can think of the nematic as coming from melting the SMECTEC, which is what one should do in these strongly correlated systems. And this is hard to do, but it's an interesting thing to do. Or you can think of it as a Fermi surface instability at weak coupling, and I will show you first how that works. So a nematic order parameter, if you begin with a two-dimensional Fermi fluid, essentially it's a 2x2 symmetric traceless tensor, as I said before. So you take your electron operator and you form this 2x2 matrix. This is not a spinner, by the way. This is a 2x2 matrix, just written in this language. And you can see it's traceless symmetric and all of that. In three dimensions, you can do the 3x3 version of this. But in two dimensions, what is special is that you can reduce this to essentially, as I said before, to a director. So you can construct this complex linear combination of the 1-1 and the 1-2 components of that. Okay, so in a sense, again, barring lattice anisotropies, you have a continuous symmetry modulo pi in this case. So the nematic state is a state in which the Fermi surface that otherwise would want to be a circle spontaneously distorts and becomes an ellipse. And roughly speaking, the eccentricity of the ellipse is a function of the order parameter. Or if you want, it's a measure of the order parameter. Okay? I imagine that some of the squash nuclei that people talk about in nuclear physics may be analogous to this in some sense. Okay, this state is uniform, it's translation invariant, and breaks rotation invariance modulo pi. Okay? It's trivial to construct, by the way, a hexatic analog of this, and we have done it, it's not published, but it's very simple to do that. Okay? Let me show you a simple Fermi liquid model. So I'm going to look at this as a Fermi liquid instability first. So imagine that you take a typical Fermi liquid, so you have some band structure here, some dispersion, and I'm going to include terms that in Fermi liquid theory are irrelevant operators. You will see that we need it to stabilize the broken symmetry state. And you will see in a moment why it's necessary. So I need to keep a term which is cubic in the dispersion. It's the first term that does that. It's not a leading term. Of course, a quadratic term is present, but doesn't do the job. So I need to go to the cubic term. And I will look at the term which you would say is a quadrupolar piece of the electron-electron interaction. So this is what in the Landau theory of the Fermi liquid is called the F2 Landau parameter. And here we are going to assume that it has some spatial dependence, so there will be some coupling constant, F2, and some inverse range kappa. This is a simple model. And this model can be solved in mean field theory, which to some extent has a number of exact features. So now I'm going to study the phase transition. I'm going to do the Landau theory of the Landau theory. Okay? So it's the Landau theory of phase transitions of the Landau theory of Fermi liquid. Okay? So I'm going to write down a density functional for the ground state, say the ground state energy, I'm going to be at zero temperature here as a function of this order parameter. It's going to have a ground state piece and a bunch of elastic constant representing essentially the gradients that can have this. This essentially is a symmetric two-dimensional differential operator. So it's a dx, dy, etc. Okay, so you can. So these are the two so-called Frank constants by analogy with the classical liquid crystals. Now the quantity of Q for the uniform state can be expanded in powers of the order parameter, and because it's a tensor, here will be a trace of Q squared, trace of Q fourth. You may argue, why not a cubic term? Because I am in two dimensions, and in two dimensions is not present. So in 3D, something like this happens is likely to be first order. In 2D, second order. The coefficients are easy to compute, at least if you do Hartree-Fock theory. The coefficient A essentially is this combination over here. And the coefficient B, and this is important, depends on various other things like the Fermi energy and so on, but depends on the coefficient of the relevant operator. So this is a bit like in the Landau theory of phase transitions. If you are above, say, if you are in 16 dimensions or in 26 dimensions, as some people like to be, this is an irrelevant operator, but you need this irrelevant operator if you're ever going to stabilize a broken symmetry state. Okay, and that's what happens here. Some irrelevant operator stabilizes it. So it's an example of a dangerous irrelevant operator in Michael Fisher's sense. Okay. So we have two phases. There is an isotropic phase and an emetic phase. And the transition happens at this point. By the way, this phase transition, if you read any book on Fermi liquid theory, this is a terrible place, usually called it a Pomeranchuk point, where the Fermi liquid becomes thermodynamically unstable. And this is what happens to the system beyond the Pomeranchuk point, or it's one of the possible things that could happen to it. In the nematic state, because you break rotation invariance spontaneously, there are Goldstone bosons associated with, which are collected modes. You can think of these as variants of zero sound. Okay? These bosons are overdamped along every direction of propagation except when they propagate along the major axis of the ellipse that the new Fermi surface has formed, where they are underdamped. So the system is very anisotropic. You can do a naive calculation, you can put a structureless impurity to an isotropic through the transport there, and you find that to lowest order in the distance to the critical point, this anisotropic tensor here, this part is like the quantity I looked at before, is linear in the real part of this order parameter. So it's an example of what I said before. Okay, and it's controlled by the, you can think of this as an isotropy in defective mass as well. That's another way to think about it. Another feature which is interesting is to go back and look at the effects of these overdamped Goldstone bosons on the quasiparticles, on the so-called fermion quasiparticles. So you do a one-loop calculation of the fermion self-energy, and what you find is that the imaginary part that tells you what the decay rate is actually very broad. So if the fermions start to propagate at directions which are not one of the directions of symmetry, you end up with an energy to the two-thirds behavior. And this is a typical so-called non-Fermi liquid system. A non-Fermi liquid is a misnomer. Either it's a Fermi liquid or it's not. To be a non-Fermi liquid is like St. Thomas Aquinas' definitions of God. God is not it's not a house, it's not a table, something like that. It doesn't define anything, right? So this is the same problem with the term known from a liquid. Now, along the symmetry directions, the energy is e to the 2/3/2, which is not the canonically square of Landau theory, but you still will end up with a pole in the spectral function. Therefore, you still have well-defined quasi-particles as along the, quote, nodal directions, if you want to use that terminology, and there will be no quasi-particles anywhere else. They will be broad. So the pneumatic phase is a known Fermi liquid with nodal excitations. In fact, the behavior of these things, of these spectral functions at the quantum critical point, are identical to those found by Patrick Lee and co-workers in the context of fermions coupled to a fluctuating gauge field. In fact, it's the same law. And it's an interesting question to figure out why they are the same. There is some evidence that, I'm not going to comment on superconductivity, it's all very preliminary in any case. So let me now go to strong coupling and tell you what the strong coupling pneumatic state might look like. So I'm going to take a lattice model. This is a recent paper that we wrote with Steve and Ted Jabal. So we involved an experimentalist in a theoretical endeavor here. And so instead of going to the canonical Hubbard model, we did something we are not supposed to do, which is to look at even more microscopic model, which is the so-called three-band or Emery model. We have the copper here, and these are the oxygens. You may complain this has too much detail, and I normally would, but you will see that some of this is actually interesting in that it reveals some additional structure of these systems at strong coupling. So imagine that you make all of the correlation energies large, in particular the on-site energies larger than the inter-site energies, and in particular that the hopping term between, say, the copper and the oxygen is large compared to the hopping term between the oxygens themselves and so on. So there is this natural hierarchy of scales, which is present in most physical systems. I'm going to take the very peculiar limit of sending them to infinity relative to that. So I'm going to do the strong coupling expansion, if you want, of this problem, to leading order only, of course. And I'm going to artificially set the TPP term to zero to begin with. You will see there are a number of interesting features. So you may suppose that I am at half filling, where there is one hole per copper, and I add an extra hole, will have to go to an oxygen site. And therefore, you have to pay an energy epsilon, which is there, and you need to pay an energy of 2 VPD to the nearby holes, which are already present. If I want to put two holes on, say, for instance, here and there, if I try to move one guy there, then you end up paying an additional VPP, which is a large energy. So you can see that anything that tries to go around the corner, so to speak, will end up being penalized by this mechanism, by these scales. So for instance, if you imagine a process in perturbation theory in which you put a hole here and then you try to hop around, this is actually, you're not paying any extra energy, these two states are degenerate. But if you try to go and turn by 90 degrees, you don't want to go from here to there or try to move this guy there, then you end up paying a large energy, and the effective hopping term you get is much smaller, it's TPD squared over VPP, which is essentially zero in this limit. So in this regime, the dynamics of this problem is essentially one-dimensional. And the two-dimensionality appears as a perturbation. It's a feature of the strong coupling expansion when you dope the systems. So you can now imagine writing down a bunch of one-dimensional Hamiltonians with their effective interactions on site energies. And this is a problem you know how to solve. And you can study that in perturbation theory. And you can ask, does this a state that breaks rotation invariance win over a state which doesn't, even in this limit? So what we find is that there are two regimes where breaking rotational symmetry works. One is sending x to zero, which is to say there's only one hole per copper, and x to one, which means that you add one hole per unit cell, which has to go on one of the oxygens. Both of these states are essentially insulating. When you dope away, they become essentially Luttinger liquids, which are coupled to each other. And you can convince yourself that if you compare the energy of the pneumatic state, which is an isotropic, to the energy of the isotropic state, the pneumatic state wins, essentially because the isotropic state will always have terms involving two nearby holes that will go like x squared, and therefore this is always a much larger energy than anything else you get from the other one. So there is a spontaneous breaking of rotational symmetry in the strong coupling limit in this simple model Hamiltonians. Okay? So that's an interesting feature. In fact, if you go all the way to the classic, let me call it the classical regime, where the energy divided by the hopping is essentially infinite. Actually, this is not really necessary, as you will see in a moment. The dope holes essentially are distributed along the oxygen sites, which I had here, which form essentially a square lattice. You can do a lattice gas analogy between occupied and unoccupied oxygen sites. And it's essentially an antiferromagnet, and the chemical potential plays a role of a uniform field. So at the classical level, which we're studying essentially a problem, it's a two-dimensional classical icing model, classical antiferromagnet with some effective exchange coupling, which is that, in a uniform field, which is a chemical potential. So if you want to work at fixed doping, it's like computing the magnetization in that problem. And this is a problem that has been studied well in the early 70s, has a line of second order transitions, a dry critical point, and then there is a line of first order transitions, and if you work as a function of doping instead of working as a function of chemical potential, this opens up into a coexistence into a two-phase region. Quantum mechanics contributes in extending this pneumatic state to lower x and creating an additional pneumatic state over here. There are additional pneumatic states that you can get down here with essentially higher order terms in the strong coupling expansion. So as you can see in this simple model, you end up with a rather complex phase diagram, essentially originating from these correlations at very strong coupling. Okay, so you end up with a rather rich phase diagram, and you can end up with quasi sort of stripy type states. The ones I have here are all pneumatic in the sense, even though they are quasi one-dimensional, they fill every unit cell, so they are uniform, and they just break rotational symmetry. So this is an example of a strong coupling lattice pneumatic state, and of course the pneumatic order parameter here is icing-like in this problem because there are only two states. It's a super exchange. That's when you integrate out the hopping through the oxygen that you get that. What I'm saying, this is the usual argument about the Hubbard model assumes that this model is equivalent to the Hubbard model, and that strong coupling is not. Okay.
That's right. Pure exchange is really a different kind of exchange, right? It's coming from this magnitude to the lattice gas. Right?
Well, that exchange here, the J that I use here is the effective coupling between the holes. Yeah, that's not the exchange interaction.
So and the one which actually gives you antiferromagnetic
interaction. I am in the strong coupling limit. I have set all of those to zero. Of course, the real problem involves spin as a harder problem, because so you need to do the TJ version of this if you want. But it tells you already that to begin with, you begin with a state which looks much different than in the ordinary TJ model, for instance.
So then you expect some physical class that these energy scales should be more important than the usual J's?
Yes. Well, the usual J's will be lower. That means that what will happen is that they will. So there will be some spin structure associated with these quantum pneumatic states, which we haven't discussed. Not only that, these quantum pneumatic states have infinite anisotropy in the way I constructed them. The the terms that I said were zero to begin with, when they are finite, essentially will induce a crossover to a two-dimensional pneumatic. And this will look like the strong coupling limit of the Landau version that I offered before. Okay. So it's an interesting model that has a virtue that gives you the states more or less for free, okay, in the strong coupling limit. So it's good to have at least some limits you understand. This is the point of this calculation, as opposed to having no limits that you understand. So let me, how much time do I have left? Okay, let me tell you a little bit about fluctuating order. Now, why do we worry about fluctuating order? We worry about that because it's very hard to see any sort of long-range order in these materials for various reasons. One, they are fairly disordered to begin with. So that's very much to the point of this conference. In fact, Jörg Schmelian, I think, will talk about that problem later on this week, about the so-called glassy state of the pin stripes. Okay. So in fact, it is an important issue because since impurity is coupled to the order parameter, they will give you naturally random fields, and then you have to worry whether it's true glassy behavior or it's an artifact of calculations, and that's it. People will debate that, I suppose. Okay, so that's a separate question. Now, on the other hand, imagine that you are to the right of some quantum critical point, as one is likely to be deep in the superconducting state. And the question is there any way to detect the presence of this sort of order, even as short-range order? Okay, that's what people call fluctuating order in practice. And in a quantum disorder state, the fluctuations are fast because a characteristic time scale is the inverse of a gap. So unless the gap is small, which is only true close to the phase transition, then tau will be short, and therefore no quasi-static probe will ever see anything. Okay? Of course, if we could detect the broken the order parameter itself, there will be no argument. So the only question is, are we seeing some sort of fluctuating order or not? So let me go over that. So the idea is that we are somewhere to the right of some quantum critical point, perhaps not too far, we don't know exactly how far, and people try to image this thing, say, with scanning tunnel microscopy as an example, or NMR, or other things like that.
Yes?
Yeah, people use these vague terms all the time, okay? So what it means is that they see it in inelastic neutron scattering. Okay, right. So they don't see it in the quasi-static regime. Okay, now, if you're close to a quantum critical point, what will happen is the following. Suppose you go to look at the charge structure factor, we have a peak at the ordering wave vector. There will be a characteristic width of the peak, which is the inverse correlation length, which will diverge as you approach the quantum critical point, and here L is the distance of this quantum critical point. Okay, it's not the magnetic length, please. Okay, it's just the distance of the quantum critical point. And similarly, by scaling, you expect that the gap will have some characteristic scaling here with a dynamical exponent z, which is typically one or two, but it could be other things. In quantum mechanics, remember that dynamics and thermodynamics are linked, and therefore one has less freedom to choose z. Now, what happens is that if you are in a quantum disorder state, this quantity has a pole for a sharply defined excitation whose quantum numbers are determined by the properties of the nearby order state. In particular, the states very close to the edge of the spectrum that you see in the spectral function here are the states that eventually become the Goldstone modes on the other side of the phase transition. If you crank up the scale of any energy that you use to probe the system, then you see the so-called continuum or the multi-particle spectrum, but you don't ever see the properties of the quantum disorder state, of the quantum order state. All you see is essentially the continuum or the quantum critical region, and in particular, in general, all of these systems have a non-vanishing anomalous dimension, which may be small, but it's finite, and means that there are no well-defined quasi-particles, if you want to use that terminology. You know, if eta is very small, then you can still pretend they are, but in fact they are not. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the difference between classical and quantum critical behavior. In a classical system, there is no natural connection between dynamics and thermodynamics, and the classical fluctuation dissipation theorem relates the structure factor S of k, the static structure factor, if you want, or the equal time piece, to the static susceptibility. And the only thing you need is the temperature. Now, therefore, a growing peak in S of k is essentially the same as a growing peak in the susceptibility, and they are one and the same thing. Okay, and then you get this very large divergence as you go through the phase transition. In a quantum system, the situation is a little different. S of k actually comes, if you do an analysis of the spectral analysis, comes from primarily from the multiparticle continuum at large frequencies, whereas chi of k comes particularly from low frequencies. So even though scaling tells you that there will be some relationship, the relationship is through this diverging time scale that you have in the problem. And therefore, even though chi charge has a strong singularity, essentially the same one that you would see, or of the type that you would see in the classical phase transition, the equal type structure factor doesn't, and in fact it may even be finite. It's usually much less divergent. Now, unfortunately, and this is the way nature works, this is what is easy to measure in a system with charge order, and this is what we would like to know. Okay? So what you can get, say, from neutron scattering or various other things is this. not that. And then you're trying to, from some weak signal here, you're trying to determine what happens there. And that's the difficulty. Okay. Now, on the other hand, we have a small amount of disorder. Again, I'm sorry for that. You guys like a lot of disorder. I only like a small amount of disorder. Then you can use the disorder as a probe on the order state. In other words, you can use the disorder as a microscope to essentially pin the system. So, for instance, if you have very few impurities, but they are rather strong, strong enough so that the characteristic scale of the disorder is large compared to the gap or the order of the gap, then they will begin to affect the states that eventually will become the Goldstone modes. Okay, so if you can do that, then basically you can study much of what's going on in the system, particularly if you're close to the critical point where this energy scale is becoming small anyways. So disorder induces, essentially wipes out the spectral gap, as we all know, but induces, therefore, a transfer of spectral wave to low frequencies all the way to the static limit. The structure that you see at low frequencies essentially reflects much of what the pure system does in the order state. It looks like a snapshot, essentially, of the order state. You are essentially localizing, if you wish, a piece of the order state. You're making it static and you can see it. And the lesson, therefore, is that weak disorder induces quasi-elastic peaks in this quantity. And this is actually what the neutron scattering people do. They integrate their data over some window, and they see the quasi-elastic part of that. And this is usually when they talk about order states, this is what they mean. Okay? All right, let me tell you a bit about response functions for charged order states. I will do this very quickly, because this actually is related to what the STM experiments show. So if you are allowed to do perturbation theory, you can say that the change in the wave component K of the density is proportional, going to be proportional to the perturbation. This defines a susceptibility by linear response theory, if you want. And if you go into the strong coupling regime, or if you are close to the, if you're close to the quantum critical point, you see that this operator here will act as a symmetry breaking field precisely because it will couple to the order parameter you're trying to measure. And so the expectation value of n at the charging wave vector here, therefore, in the quantum critical regime, we have this non-trivial exponent, which is similar to a magnetic field. Normally, we think of this as magnetization going like h to the 1 over delta. This will have a similar effect. So there will be a linear regime and then a non-linear regime when you get into the quantum critical regime. Now, an example of this is STM. So in STM, what they measure is the local density of states. In the pure system, the density of states is uniform. It's independent of R. So if you compute a Fourier transform as a delta function of zero wave vector. Okay? And that's what the STM experiment is supposed to show. If you have a small amount of disorder, then you can say that the change in this Fourier transform version of that will be proportional to VK, and this will be, they will define a susceptibility associated with this density of states. Okay? Now that susceptibility can be written in terms of a three-point function involving two fermion operators and a density here. So you can compute that in the usual way. And of course, you can relate that to the static charge susceptibility if you do an integral over the spectrum with the Fermi function here. Okay, so in fact, if you know this quantity here and you integrate over energy, you can directly find the charge susceptibility. Now, in the case of pneumatic order, it's more complicated because this is not good for that. Pneumatic order will have to be sensitive to breaking rotational symmetry, so you need to go to a nonlinear susceptibility to do that. So let me show you some. I'm not going to talk about some of the quasi. Let me show you something, and then I will come back to that. So let me show you a one-dimensional STM experiment. So imagine you have a one-dimensional Luttinger liquid that you can think of that as a quantum critical system, and you put a tip here, so it's essentially a backscattering center over here. It's a relevant perturbation that will induce order because it's going to pin the charge density wave. So it's again order from disorder in this case. And what happens if the energy scale is low compared to the characteristic crossover scale that was studied by Matthew and Charlie Kane here a number of years ago? Then what you see is that if you compute the fermion Green's function here, you compute the Fourier transform, you can end up essentially showing that the quantity I defined before close to the ordering wave vector 2kF has its scaling form. Let me show you that this is a system which is a prototype of a system, quote, without quasi-particles. In other words, has solitons only, which are spin charge separated. They are spinons and holons, or I guess here they are called chargeons. So I have to change the terminology. And in addition to that, there will be an ordering peak that you will see in a moment. You can think of that as being induced order. It's due to the presence of impurity. So the left panel here is the STM spectrum. This is essentially the spectral function that you say will measure in photoemission. And you see this propagating peaks associated with the so-called charged soliton and spin soliton. So this is spin charge separation as in the system that ought to have it. Okay, so there aren't any electron quasi-particles here. In addition to these two, you see this additional induced order, which is this feature here that appears at zero at 2kF. This is a strong coupling version of that. Let me not get into that. So what you should see is both a peak associated with induced order in this quantum critical system, as well as propagating excitations, which are present. So let me now jump into the STM experiments. Okay, well, let me show you some experiments. This is neutron scattering. This is what people call fluctuating order or dynamical stripes that Primi referred to before. So they appear only in the inelastic neutron scattering. They are broad, and they have a characteristic peak. If you put some, so this is optimally doped lantern strontium copper oxide. If they put enough neodymium, they can pin this, and you end up with long-range order, but you kill the superconductivity in the process. So you end up with pin stripes in this case. And you see that this becomes essentially very sharp, and it's actually going into the static regime. So this is an example where the impurities induce actual long-range order. Of course, it's distorted order. It's not true. It may be glassy in reality. Okay. On the other hand, if you go back to optimally doped LSCO, and you put very small amounts of zinc, you can see it's a very tiny amount of zinc, again, they see something at 2 MeVs. They see nothing at zero energy. So this is what, again, is an example of an inelastic effect, dynamical stripes back again. But here, once they put zinc, they still see something which is, if anything, is broader than it was before. But at zero energy now, they see something very sharp. So this is an example of induced order, and TC actually hasn't varied by less than 10%. So this is deep in the superconducting state. So it induces order, and the order is induced by the zinc impurities in this case. So you may think of this as being a quantum disorder stripe state, and the order that is seen here is induced by the impurities, very much as in this quasi one-dimensional example I just discussed. Okay. So this is what neutron scattering shows. This is an STM spectrum. Unfortunately, I don't have a good picture of this. So this is a Fourier transform of the STM density of states from the Stanford group. And they see, well, they see a lot of things, but in particular, one of the things they see are these dots over here that go along the copper oxide bonds. And they see these peaks that don't propagate. And this is part of the controversy is whether there is anything that doesn't propagate or not. And you will see in a moment why. If you make some circles here and compute the anti-transform of what is coming from these regions, then you end up with these patterns that look stripy, and they have dislocations in there with a characteristic length scale of 80 to 100 angstroms. Okay, so in a sense, it's an image of that. Now, this is not a very large system. You see, it's 250 angstroms by 250 angstroms in the experiment. The Berkeley group, and I'm almost finished, sees the following. This is the detail of their data. So what they see essentially is along the pi-pi direction, they see things that fit the... So you can compare two experiments. You can compare the STM spectrum to what they do in angle resolved photoemission, which essentially is like measuring E as a function of K. Okay, you can measure the spectrum if you want. And they essentially match very well along the pi-pi direction, along the so-called nodal direction. But here, along the direction, going along the copper oxide direction, for a while, they fit well, and then they systematically deviate as they get close to essentially a quarter of the way in the Brillouin zone, and that's where these peaks here sit. So we want to argue what the experimentalists are seeing here are propagating quasi-particles in all directions, except that here, where nothing ought to exist because it's inside the gap, they are seeing induced order. Okay, and again, the question is, what is the length scale? The length scale of this is actually of the order of 80 angstroms. And actually, there is some older data. If you take, for instance, the Stanford group's data and you integrate it up to some voltage and compare with what the voltage is, you see that this feature at a quarter of the way simply gets better, actually, when you do that. Now, there is a very spectacular data from Yazdani's group in Urbana, who has been able to go above TC, 20% above TC, in fact, has a sample of a TC of 85 degrees, and he's gone to 100 degrees. And all of these propagating quasi-particle features are gone, as they should, since there are no quasi-particles in the so-called pseudo-gap state. But this feature over here is still there. The only thing is it's slightly incommensurate in his data, but it's actually, in fact, much sharper than what the Stanford group found, simply because it has better data. Okay, so there is quite a bit of that. The length scale he sees is also of the same order, and it's the same length scale seen by the Berkeley group some time ago when they looked at induced order induced by a vortex in the mixed state. So this is suggesting that, in fact, one is seeing short-range charge order on a length scale which is about an order of magnitude, say 10 coherence lengths of the superconductor. Okay, and this is in optimally doped BISCO, this is the best high temperature superconductor there is in this sense. And there are reasons for why some others may be better. Okay, so these are my conclusions. So I will just flash on top here for you, and I will stop here.
Thank you very much.